Welcome to the Practical EdTech Podcast. This is episode number 6. This episode is a conversation with Dr. Scott McLeod. We're talking about his new book, Harnessing Technology for Deeper Learning. But before we got into that conversation, we talked a bit about the evolution of the educational technology in the 12 years since his viral video, Did You Know or Shift Happens, was released. It was a great conversation, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. So my guest today is Dr. Scott McLeod, who I've known for 10 or more years, and which dates both of us, I guess. He knew me before I had gray hair, so that says something. You probably know Scott's work, even if you don't know his name. You've probably seen some variation of Did You Know or Shift Happens. He was instrumental in the early days of that. You might have read one of his earlier books or his most recent book with his co-author, Julie Graver, Harnessing Technology for Deeper Learning. So, Scott, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Richard. Thanks. Good to see you again.
Hey, likewise. Thanks for agreeing to do this again. So for folks who maybe have seen, Shift Happens or Did You Know, that was when did you and Carl do that? That was 2005, 2006?
Yeah, 2006, early 2007. Yep, depending on which version you're talking about.
Yeah. So what's happened in the ensuing 12 years, 13 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I had a chance to reflect on that with EdSurge in a podcast I did for them last year. I think, the Did You Know Shift Happens videos really took off quite fast. They somehow captured the pace of change that was happening in society around us. And, we heard from thousands of people that it was just sweeping through their organizations at conferences and so on. We think about 100 million people or so actually saw one of the 5 videos, if not more. And people still come up to me and be like, yeah, we're still using those. I'm like, okay, because they're out of date. But, I think for all the rhetoric behind the videos and all the urgency that people seem to feel around what's happening around us, systems are slow to change. And so, are we having different conversations than we were having 10, 12 years ago? Absolutely. Did the videos help with that? Sure, at least a little bit. Are we anywhere near where we hoped we'd be with our naive optimism a dozen years ago? Absolutely no way.
You go back and you watch those videos today, and in fact, I have it bookmarked on my own YouTube channel. One of the versions, I would probably the 2007 version, and it still mentions MySpace, right? It mentioned MySpace and the growth of MySpace. And I was just listening an hour ago to a Gary Vaynerchuk podcast. Actually, the podcast was a recording of a keynote he gave in Melbourne, and he was talking about TikTok, right? And where TikTok is right now is it's with 8 to 12 year old girls mostly, but that's where MySpace was too. And where was Facebook when it started? It was with college kids, and now everyone's on those platforms. So, the tech tool itself might have changed, but I think the conversation might still be very, very relevant. So, speaking of TikTok, do you have anyone in your life that's on TikTok?
No, my kids are all a little older than that. So no TikTok in my house.
Do you have any opinion about TikTok? I mean, Vaynerchuk, and for folks who are listening who may not be familiar with Gary Vaynerchuk, he's a business marketing guru, I guess, for lack of a better term. He thinks that's where adults are going to be in 5 or 6 years. Give me any thoughts about that at all? Or, you follow the shifts, kind of.
Yeah, I don't really prognosticate. You'd actually be better at that than I do. I think tools change, they morph, they adapt. We pick up stuff, we use them for a few years. I think the underlying human needs of communication and connection and sharing and, you know, those kinds of needs will always be there. So as our tools get more and more capable, we'll migrate to new platforms and new tools. Yep. Have fun with TikTok while it lasts.
Exactly. Now, or have fun with Twitter while it lasts. With the, you know, yeah. Like Twitter. I'm not sure when you got on Twitter, but I know I got on Twitter in early 2007. So it's been 12 years of tweeting out in the world. And you and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, that's been a shift, right? There's been a change in the way that we use Twitter, but it still exists. And I think one of the things I should tell all podcast listeners, all 130 of you, Scott always stood out to me as being someone who, yes, had this viral video, but yet you also engaged in the conversation. You were very good at, you know, asking questions to facilitate thought without pontificating, I think is probably the best way to describe one of the ways that you've kind of stood out over time. And I think that's an interesting way to use social media. I think a lot of people end up with one or the other. You know, they're going to do the viral thing, or they're going to do the antagonizing question thing, but not both. And somehow you managed to do both of those.
Well, I mean, the viral video was just luck, right? It was good timing in the world, I guess. You know, maybe it's the professor in me, Richard, but I got lots of questions, right? So, and I think, you know, if we want schools to change and we want kids learning to change, we have to keep asking questions, you know, because there's lots of questions that we need to get answered. So.
Well, so let me ask you about asking questions.
Sure.
You have a way of asking questions that doesn't come across with a hidden agenda behind it, right? Like a genuine curiosity of what does somebody think about X, Y, or Z. Is that something you've worked at, or is that something that just came naturally to you to just be inquisitive and ask these questions?
Yeah, I don't know if everybody would agree with you that I don't have an agenda. I mean, I clearly have.
Well, you do. And anyone who follows you knows that. But I think you ask them let me rephrase it. You ask it in a polite way.
So I went to law school, and they teach you how to have conversations with people you disagree with. You actually argue quite vehemently with people that you disagree with, and yet still walk away recognizing that the conversation and the dialogue and both sides are important. And so that was a pretty formative experience for me. So, you know, there is no one truth in any of this. We all have bits and pieces of the truth, so we have to be willing to dialogue and engage. So I feel like I'm willing to ask hard questions, but I'm also willing to listen really well to pushback and feedback and contrary opinions. And I'll have that dialogue with anybody who's willing to have it. So as long as, like you said, we're kind of polite and not insulting.
Right. And I think that's you've actually facilitated this is going back, I don't know, 10 years ago, probably. You facilitated or brokered a peace treaty between myself and somebody else once in a little Twitter spat offline. I'm not even sure if you remember that, remember doing that or not. But I was like, yeah, that is a good way to kind of, yeah, it's just Twitter after all, right?
Right. Sure. Well, we're passionate about what we're passionate about. And so that comes through. The challenge of Twitter is a shortage of characters. So, you know, and those of us like you and me who come from the blogging world, right? We're used to having longer form to express our opinions. And we're also, if we're old enough bloggers, we remember when commenting was the thing, right? And we would have these rich conversations in the comment spaces. Now, Twitter can't replicate that, but even in Twitter and other platforms, we can at least strive for some dialogue.
So, well, speaking of the dialogue, the work you're doing today, and you were telling me a couple of weeks ago, a lot of the work you're doing right now with school leaders does involve a lot of ongoing conversation and not doing one-off
right.
workshop presentation things, but actually ongoing dialogue. And what's that work look like today? You know, what are the conversations you're leading the most in those cohorts you're working with today?
Yeah, so just a quick rundown for your listeners. So I've had several states and districts give me large groups of leaders for extended engagements. So for example, in North Dakota, last year, I had 72 school leaders spend 7 days with me between October and May. Currently this year in Virginia, we have 156 school leaders from 31 districts. And we're meeting 6 times together between March and December, right? I've had whole districts giving their leadership teams for 5 to 7 days over the course of a school year. You know, the idea with all of these is to have longer term engagements and conversations where we can actually not only come to some common understandings, but also some shared agreements and commitments about where we'll go next as a state, as districts, you know, whatever. So in terms of what we've been talking about, it really depends on the group. But I think, you know, the kind of conversations that we were having a decade ago, and this is what I alluded to earlier when I said that we're having different conversations, like we don't seem to be to need the sell job as much as we used to, right? Like we don't, when you go talk to most people are slowly, you know, at some level bought into the idea that school's going to need to change. Right, we live in a rapidly changing environment around us. We have to adapt if we want to be relevant, and so on. They've had numerous speakers and facilitators work with them, and you know they've read stuff. Their mindset really isn't on the why as much anymore. I mean, I still think we need to keep the why at the forefront, but it's not as important as maybe it used to be, in some ways. But what that allows us to do then is then have the conversation about how do we get there, right? And what are the pathways and what are the, you know, the folks I work with, what are those leadership behaviors and support structures that help your staff and your students and your parents and your communities start moving in different directions? What's your job as the principal, superintendent, school board, whatever, right? And so those seem to be where the conversations are. It's, you know, it's a little bit of remember this is why we're doing this, but it's mostly around the how.
And that's kind of a good tie into the book, the new book, Harnessing Technology for Deeper Learning, of Scott McCloud and Julie Graber. It's a quick read. You told me I'd read it in an hour and a half. It was more like 4.
Okay, sorry.
But that's more the nature of me underlining and taking notes in the book than it is a statement about the book itself. That's more a statement about the reader than it is the authors of the book, because the book is 57 pages, more or less. Right?
Yeah. Well, thanks for being a thoughtful reader.
I'm sorry?
Thanks for being a thoughtful reader.
Well, I try. But the book is it's a how-to, but it's not a how-to as in push here, click here, assemble this. It's a how-to in terms of framework and thinking, right? And maybe not even thinking more. Well, yeah, it is the thinking. A how to think about how to change what we're doing. One of the examples that you gave in here was the mystery Skype, which is kind of the darling of elementary schools for a couple of years, right? And talking about how you can make that a bit deeper than kids huddled around the Skype machine and asking some random questions. Right? And the other one, the one that I actually wrote a blog post about, was about the book Flip Snack, the Flip Snack books, right? And what do you do to go beyond just kids make little pumpkins to represent the books that they read, right? And actually thinking about the theme within the book. And so rather than just here are my favorite parts of the book or here's my favorite character from the book, here's the theme, the ELA theme that we're talking about. So I'm probably doing a very poor job of representing the book in just those two examples. So maybe you can tell me a little bit more about, what was the thinking in putting that book together? Because you've written much longer books. This is a short book.
Yeah, no, I think you did a great job. So, you know, the goal of harnessing technology for deeper learning was really to take some of the ideas from an earlier book, Different Schools for a Different World, and which was more the why book, and talk about how do we translate those new 21st century vision statements and profiles of a graduate and rhetorics into day-to-day classroom practice, right? Like I visit a lot of schools and school districts where they'll have some kind of fancy, you know, 21st century learning framework prominently displayed in their school hallway or website, right? But then you walk down the halls and you visit classes and instruction mostly looks the same as it did 10, 15, 20, 40, 50 years ago. So the intent of the Harnessing Technology for Deeper Learning book was to really talk about instructional redesign. If we want our kids to be deeper thinkers and learners, if we want them to be engaged in the outside world around them, if we want them to have agency and ownership and control over their own learning more often, right? And if we want to use technology as a powerful lever to make that happen, then we have to design for those things. They don't just happen by magic. So the Four Shifts Protocol, which is introduced in the book, contains sets of questions that help teachers think about how they might shift an existing lesson or unit in some new directions. And to do that in a non-judgmental way, to really just say, for example, all right, pick something you're working on next week and or, you know, some unit that you're planning in the future, and then say, what are some of those larger student outcomes that we want beyond content, right? And if one of those, you know, outcomes, for example, is we want kids to practice being those lifelong learners that we say we want, which means that they have to have some autonomy over their own learning, then here's 9 different ways that we could potentially shift this lesson or unit towards more student agency, for example, right? And then so in the book, we have, I think, 8 different lesson redesign examples, as well as introducing the protocol, along with a bunch of tips and suggestions for how to use the protocol in your school. So that's basically it.
Yeah. Well, you get to the heart of a question that anyone who's done any work in schools in the last couple of years and has to ask, and that's kind of the what's next, right? I think what's useful about the protocols is that it addresses what's next right now, but 2 years from now, you can also use that to address what's next. I think a lot of times when we think of what's next, particularly with educational technology, we think about what's the next technology, but not necessarily what's the next shift in the learning and the learning outcomes.
Right. Well, and as you and I have been talking, and as you and I know, the tech comes and goes, right? And there's always a shiny, fancy tool that looks cool. And there's always the danger, because you and I both like technology, right? And we see our colleagues do this too. There's always the danger of jumping on a tool, right, and framing things through the lens of the tool instead of through the lens of the learning. You know, oh, look at this great thing. It's Edmodo, it's Kahoot, it's Flipgrid, it's whatever, right? But bottom line is we have to keep coming back. What kind of learning are we trying to make happen? And if we're using those tools, ways that continue to reinforce factual recall and procedural regurgitation only, right, then we're not preparing kids who can really thrive in 2020 and beyond. We have to go deeper. We have to be more authentic. We have to have kids own their learning in different ways. And that means we have to design for it. But, you know, you can use most of these technology tools in rich, robust ways or fairly traditional replicative ways. And it's really up to us to keep the focus on the kind of learning we want to make happen.
Well, I think one of the statements that I'm hearing more and more, you mentioned Kahoot, and I want to pick on Kahoot. But it could be any technology, really, is the statement, our kids are bored with Kahoot, or our kids are bored with Flipgrid, right? Or they're bored with whatever thing that 3 years ago, or 4 years ago, 5 years ago, whenever Kahoot came out now, I remember putting it up on a big screen in front of 800 people at a conference in North Carolina, and everybody was wowed by it. And now people are saying, well, my kids are bored with that. What else can we do? And I think that gets to the heart of what makes a technology built to last and what makes a framework built to last, you know, at the end of the day, some of those things are just replication of what we've done in our classroom, whereas the technologies that are really built to last are the things that, you know, in some ways have, you know, become passe, right? I think about Gary Steger. Right? He's been talking about programming since the dawn of programming. And Gary, if you happen to listen to this, I mean this in the nicest way possible. But he's been talking about programming with students since the 80s. Right? And if you hear him talk about Scratch or Logo, you know, he's still touting that. And you know, it's a very powerful tool, and it's a tool that's built to last. Whereas, you know, no one's asking what's going to replace Scratch or what's going to replace programming, right? No one's asking what's going to replace programming. It's, is there a better way to program? Is there an easier way to program? But no one's asking what's going to replace program. A lot of people are asking what's going to replace Kahoot, what's going to replace Flipgrid.
Yeah. Right, because you might get bored with the tool, but kids never get bored with meaningful and powerful learning.
Yeah.
Right? And so, you know, there's this concept of low floor, high ceiling. So you want your technology tools to have a low floor in the sense that they're easy to get into at the beginning, right? Like it doesn't require a steep learning curve. But then you also want them to have a high ceiling, which means that you can use them in a variety of ways and in very deep ways, not just shallow ways. So the technologies that seem to last are the ones that are more open-ended, that allow for a lot of divergence and creativity and, you know, orientation and along multiple pathways, right? That's why tools like Scratch, right, which can be used in a variety of directions, will hold for a long time, right? Whereas something that's more limited, like an interactive whiteboard, which is fundamentally designed to only do a certain thing in a certain way, right, are going to have less staying power. And so when we're looking at software tools or devices, you know, the laptop is always more powerful than, you know, say a Kahoot, because the laptop is more open-ended and allows for a much more creative range of uses.
Oh, and I think we've come to that place with a lot of the hardware. Right? I can remember sitting around at ISTE, may have still been called the NEC conference, but when the first iPads came out, and there was a roundtable about what can we do with this? Is it gonna, and there are people who were, willing to, you know, go to the grave saying that the iPad was going to be this wonderful thing, and now we're looking at schools going, well, yeah, we bought a lot of iPads, and realizing, well, maybe it's not as useful as I thought it would be. And that might just be the maturation of technology too, right? Of, you want it to be this thing that keeps evolving, right? And that's part of it. Well, I'm ranting now about Apple's ecosystem, but part of Apple's model is that eventually it's going to stop working, right? And you need to buy the next one. Right?
Yeah. No, that all makes sense. I think, you know, the thing for me is that, you know, you said we've kind of got used to that idea on the hardware side. We haven't got used to that on the software side yet as much. But I think the question that we need to keep asking ourselves is, it's technology for the purpose of what? And I think what we've seen over and over again is that the technologies that get adopted the quickest and the widest by teachers, right, are the ones that replicate what they already have been doing, right? So I used to lecture with a whiteboard or chalkboard. Now I have an interactive whiteboard with a few more bells and whistles, right? And I can wrap my head around that. I can wrap my head around shoving videos out of my kids like I used to do with the DVD or VCR cart that I rolled down the hallway, right? Clicker systems or, you know, Nearpod like control systems where I can see what my kids are doing, right? Which allows me to be the dominant figure up front controlling the classroom. Like, these are the things where, you know, they reinforce my conceptions of what teaching looks like and how I should be as a teacher, right? They're not disruptive technologies. And those are the ones that get adopted. I think the challenge for us is that as we move towards having classrooms be hopefully less teacher directed and more student owned, is that we're bucking against that culture, right? And the technologies that actually put more power in the hands of kids, right? are actually seem more daunting or threatening or intimidating to teachers who are more hesitant to adopt those.
So you mentioned Nearpod, and again, I try to avoid picking on any one company or product as much as I can. But you said something about Nearpod where the teacher is in control, right? Getting control. And one of the questions that I'm sure you get and that I get quite a bit, particularly this time of year as school is starting up, what programs can I use to see what's happening on my kid's computer, right? Or on my kid's iPad or phone or whatever tablet it is? And that might be a question from parents. I definitely hear from parents. And last year I worked with a school where I was able to sit in on many PTA meetings as well as sitting in with teachers. And that's a question that parents ask, and a lot of teachers ask that question. How do you handle that? Because I know, having known you, that you want to give students as much agency as possible, but I also know that you worked in taught high school social studies, and so you know how high school students can be sometimes. So how do you balance that equation?
Yeah, so I always like to start the conversation by reminding people what they were like when they were children, right? And particularly flashback to high school, maybe, or middle school, and can you remember how often you were bored? I do. I vividly remember how often I was bored in high school, and I'm 51 now. So, just recognize that kids today are not any different than we were. They just have different opportunities, right? Like if I had had Facebook or a smartphone with texting capability or Instagram or whatever when I was in high school, believe me, I would have headed that direction a lot during the school day, right? Because it was much more compelling than what was happening in front of me in the classroom, right? So, and I think we just have to own that, right? It's not that kids are, any worse or terrible compared to when, the golden age of when we were kids, whatever. Like, humanity has not changed that fast. So then the question is, so what's the answer to that? And the answer is you can either take the approach of, one end of the continuum is locking things down and banning things, right? So, the high school in California that just got publicity for being the largest high school in the country to ban cell phones, or the command and control mechanism, we're going to tightly filter and block and see everybody's screens and control exactly what you can see and do. Like, that's one end of the continuum, right? The other end of the continuum is, instead of addressing the symptoms, why don't we address the root cause, which is disengaging learning? Right? So if learning is disengaging, why don't we work on our instruction and give our kids more meaningful tasks so that they're less tempted to be distracted, right? Because now they're engaged in the learning itself. And yes, we'll still have the inevitable daydreamer, right? And there's some worth in that. Like, we don't want to eliminate all daydreaming or distraction, and the human mind can only concentrate for so long. We can't pretend otherwise and to punish people. But at the same time, the best solution to that is, on the other end of the continuum, is some kind of combination of good, rich instruction and learning opportunities combined with get up off your feet and walk around the classroom and engage with kids and see what they're doing, right? So, and you don't need software to tell you what's happening on the screen, because you're right there next to the kid, engaging with them and helping them learn and having great discussions. I mean, that's the solution in my head.
Well, that hit on a non-technology based solution, right? That David Jakes and Bob Dylan and some other people are working on, with the classroom design itself. Do you have rows of four or five, and that's your 20 kids or 25 students, or do you have it set up in a way that you're actually making it more conducive to learning and exploring? And I cannot pretend to be an expert on what exactly both of those gentlemen that I mentioned are doing, but I know a lot of it is on that classroom design or school design piece.
Yeah, well, and you can sort of see it, right? If your dominant modality of teaching is that you're up front and you're pushing information out to students and you're staring at the back of a bunch of screens, right? iPads, Chromebooks, laptops, whatever, and you can't see what the kids are doing, then the temptation is there to have some screen that faces you so you can at least monitor what they're up to, right? But that's traditional teaching, right? And you're setting yourself up for disengagement and distraction because of the way you set up the learning scenario, right? If you don't want that to happen, set up a different scenario.
Well, and the other element to consider, I think, maybe you weigh, hopefully you can weigh in on this as well, deals with the access to the technology itself. Having worked in a school district where the vast majority of students qualified for free lunch, that the school is the place where you have that access to either the device itself or you have the access to the internet because you don't have it outside of that.
Absolutely.
That becomes a part of the distraction, if you will, is that this is my only chance. This is my only chance. So my first thing to do is to catch up to see what messages my friends have sent me. My second thing to do is whatever Mr. Byrne told me to do or whatever, you know, we're supposed to be doing, right?
Right? Yeah, no, that's an excellent point, right? And we don't, you know, we have schools so tightly structured and controlled that kids never have those opportunities to just engage in a digital space and online environments, right, in less structured, more informal ways that feed their needs, not ours. And if that's, and like you said, if that's the only place they have access, right, we shouldn't be surprised when they get pulled that direction. Yeah. I don't think the answer is locking it all down and blocking and controlling even more tightly.
No, I think that that would foster more creativity on how to get around the blocking and the filtering.
It does. We see that in practice all over.
Well, we even see it in professional development settings. Right? Go to any professional development workshop or conference, and as we look, you know, you look around in the back of the room, even when people self-select the places, the workshop they want to go to or the presentation they want to go to, yeah, we're checking in on our email or we're checking in with, you know, whatever item is out there. And so I think that's partly it's just human nature, right? Of we have multitasking brains, so we have multi-thinking brains at least. Right? Even if we're not tasking well, we're thinking all the time.
Right? Yeah, yeah, and you know, there's things that we divide our full attention to, and there's things that we can give partial attention to while doing something else, right? And the literature says pretty clearly that when you're multitasking like that, right, like you're not able to do either or as many of those things as well as if you did them just by themselves, that makes sense. And at the same time, maybe I don't need to give my full attention to this thing, right? Because I'm going to also do this other thing at the same time. And that other thing might actually be related to the first thing, right? Like I might be checking my email during your conference presentation, but I also might be tweeting out the awesome ideas that you're sharing, right? Like you just don't know. So I never sweat it as a presenter. I just figure, hey, I'm glad you're in the room. And, you know, if we're meeting your needs, thanks for staying. And if not, go do something else. You know, like, meet your own learning needs, whatever works for you.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you can learn anything, right? If you want to, I know for myself, I was at a conference back in April that I was invited to speak at, and I had a down session, and I got to sit in on one of Dan Russell's presentations. Dan, for folks who don't know who Dan Russell is, he's Google's head of search. I think his title is Search Enjoyment or Search Happiness. It's something very googly, like head of search. You can call it search experience, but that's not the real title. It's like search happiness or user happiness. User happiness is what it is.
Nice.
Anyway, he's given this, and I've known him for 10 years or more, and I've seen him speak many, many times. And but I wanted to go and see what he was working on now. And you know, I'm sitting there, and I'm doing exactly what you mentioned. Like, okay, I've seen this. I've seen this part before. I know what's coming next. I know the answer to this problem he's giving on the board. Or not the board, but, you know, giving the problem he's giving. I'm going to go and look up this other little thing that he mentioned in passing. Right? Right. That's not even a part of the presentation. I'm going to look up this little thing. And I think some of that is, you know, I do that as a 40-year-old, and I think teenagers do it as well. Like, oh, Mr. Byrne mentioned X, Y, or Z in passing. I want to look up that. Forget all about whatever he was talking about with the War of 1812. What's this other little thing he just mentioned? So yeah, it's kind of natural, and it's an adjustment. It's definitely an adjustment for us as teachers. And, you know, I'm completely blanking on his name now. He wrote The World is Open. The book is behind you on the shelf too.
Is that Curtis?
Yeah, Curtis Bonk. Thank you. In his book, he uses the term the Google jockey, right? There's the student who Googles everything. And that made it really hard as a shift for us to be the experts in the room anymore. And I think we're finally embracing that, but it's been a long way. So to wrap this up, we've talked about a wide range of things. Where can people find you, see you? By the way, we never mentioned what your real day job is or what your primary day job is. We talked about the workshops you do and the work you're doing with North Dakota and in Virginia, but you live outside of Denver. What's your day job, if you will? Yeah,
my formal title is Associate Professor of Educational Leadership. I prepare principals and superintendents at the University of Colorado, Denver campus, not Boulder campus, because that's where the Ed Leadership Program is. As you mentioned, I live about half an hour north of Denver, about 15 minutes east of Boulder in a town called Lafayette. So most of my work is running two principal licensure cohorts here with a couple of innovative districts in the state of Colorado and, you know, advising doctoral students and getting them graduated with their dissertations and all the usual professor stuff around research and writing, that kind of good stuff.
Cool. And we can find your book, Harnessing Technology for Deeper Learning. We can find it on Amazon, of course, but your blog is still dangerously irrelevant.
Yeah,
that is not a joke. That's the blog. It's dangerously irrelevant, and you can find all of Scott's social media links there. What else should they know? Where else can they find you?
You can find me on Twitter at McLeod, McLeod. I'm on both Facebook and Instagram as Scott McLeod, ScottMcLeod. And I'll also point out that on the blog, dangerously irrelevant, the Four Shifts Protocol itself is free. So people all over are using the protocol to redesign lessons and units. It doesn't cost anything. It's open source. You can modify it any way you want. And so there's a whole Four Shifts resource area on the blog that people should probably check out if they're interested. And, you know, the book just has redesign examples and some tips and suggestions. But the protocol itself is available to anybody anytime.
And with the book, tons of references and additional resources, which I think is useful as well, as someone who likes to, if you're the type of person who likes to look at where did the authors get their ideas or what did they cite, which is me. This is a habit I started 20 plus years ago. First thing I look at is actually the resources, and you know, that's probably why I love Google Scholar too, because you can track backwards to see where's the work been cited before you got to this work. So
absolutely, we should always give credit where it's due.
Fantastic read. You can go to Dangerously Irrelevant and get the Four Shifts Protocol there, or get the book, or get any of the other books on Amazon. And reach out to Scott. Say hi. He's very friendly.
Yeah, I like the dialogue and converse.
So yeah,
get in touch. Yeah,
very, very friendly, and you're usually at ISTE, right?
Yes, usually at ISTE.
Usually at ISTE and other conferences around the globe. So if you happen to find yourself in a conference that Scott's presenting at, do yourself a favor and go check it out. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Richard.